John Murray on 2nd March 1978 at Radio Physics in Sydney. Now, the first publication in radio astronomy that you're involved with is in 1953, but you've just been telling me that you were working in the radio physics group a number of years earlier. Could you just tell me what your educational background was and then how you came to radio physics?
Yes, I came to radio physics in January 1948. I just applied for a job which was advertised in a paper in Hobart. And as I was looking around for a job, I gave it a fly and managed to land it. It was not for radio astronomy. It was for work on an electronic computer which was to be built, and which actually was built here. I never did any work on that computer. At the time, I hadn't graduated. I was doing an engineering course part-time and finding it pretty hard crunching financially. And so I got permission, if I got a job, this sort of job in Sydney, I could continue to do the work towards a bachelor's degree, which I got in 1950.
In electrical engineering? In
mechanical engineering.
Mechanical engineering, I see.
I had done a lot of electronics, but there were no formal courses in electronics at the University of Tasmania at the time. Mm-hmm. There was a course in electrical engineering, which I'd done, but this was power engineering.
So when did you first come in contact with the radio astronomy people?
Straight away, I was taken around by Lindsay McCready, introduced to various people, and sort of told not to worry about the computer. I probably wouldn't see that. And was put to work to build a preamplifier for 200 and 300 megahertz tube preamplifier. So this worked fairly well, and from that time, I think I was in the radio astronomy group.
I see. And what was that used for?
That was used just as a preamplifier for some of the receivers, the fixed frequency receivers, monitoring the sun. After that, I was landed a job to make a very slow time base. I wasn't told what this was for, so it was something to sweep an oscilloscope very slowly. And I worked on this and looked like being a bit of a dead end, and then Lindsay took me down and said, oh, perhaps you'd better meet Paul Wilde. And so he took me down and introduced me to Paul Wilde, who I hadn't met because Paul was tucked away in the test room, and we had no cafeteria or anything at that time, mm-hmm. so we didn't meet each other very much. And there was still a lot of the feeling of secrecy left over from the war.
Really? So people didn't communicate with each other about what they were doing?
No, there was very little communication. You knew the people in the immediate vicinity of the room in which you worked, and that was about all.
That's an interesting comment. Do you think that was a leftover from the war to some extent?
Certainly in McCready's case, because he was very security conscious about all sorts of things. And I think he had an industrial background, and one of the ideas there was never let your competitor know what was going on.
Sure.
So after a talk together, we decided that, well, we were working on little different bits of the same project. And of course, they didn't match up very well. So it turned out that this was to be a swept frequency receiver. I forget the frequency range.
Do I have it written down here? It was something like 40 to 200.
No, this was the earlier
model. This is a first one, I'm sorry.
This was an earlier model. This was 1948.
Oh, good heavens, were we?
This was the immediate follow-up to the observed delay in arrival times of bursts at different frequencies.
Which Payne Scott and Yapsley, I guess.
That's right, yes.
That's it.
So we had a receiver working by about the third quarter of 1948. And we realised from running it in Sydney that it'd be absolutely hopeless unless we got a site which was relatively free of interference.
Mm-hmm.
And we found a site out at Penrith. This was quite close to the town. It was on the other side of the railway line from the town, so there was no building on that side. The railway line just cut the town off on one side.
I see.
And we found this was an acceptable spot, except that when we put the antenna well down and look towards Sydney, we could get about 1,000,000 degrees. and uh, but that didn't matter too much because we were well west, and we only observed a few hours of the day. The antenna we had was a rhombic, single polarization, horizontally, more or less horizontally polarized, on a wooden frame, which was steered by a series of ropes. It had an elementary polar axis, which was just about the size of the universal joint of a car.
I see.
Sat on the ground on a concrete block in the ground. There was the long centre arm of the rhombic.
But these ropes were pulled automatically?
They were not. No. They were in the best fashion by letting one go and wire wrapping around bollards and we did everything by hand.
I see. So how broad was the beam? How often did you have to move it?
Oh, we used to move about every half hour. It was a very broad beam. It was a peculiar arrangement. There was this rhombic which was suspended from a large telegraph post from the point which is the prolongation of the polar axis.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the declination rope which we took up or let down, depending on the declination of the sun. And then the rhombic would then just swing round on this rope, and we had two other ropes, one from each side, which we'd let one out and take the other one in. Well, I wrecked the antenna one day because it was rather wet and the ground was clay and very greasy, and I thought I had enough turns on the bollards for one rope.
Uh-huh.
And it's just messing out, and all of a sudden it started slipping, and the bollards was well lubricated by the clay, so it just kept swinging around. The side crashed into the ground. Still, it was only a wooden device, and the carbon was fixed it up in a day or so. There's no trouble. Now, the receiver we had there was the original swept frequency device, and some bursts were obtained on that.
Were there any other special problems in the receiver that, from a technical point of view? It was the only one of its kind at that time, was it not?
Well, everything had to be driven mechanically. We had no such things as varactors or anything like this, so the tuning was motor-driven. We had these butterfly capacitors which were driven, we swept in about half a second, a second. The data adapter one took about 2 seconds per sweep, but this other one was rather faster in the sweep, but only a single band. The adapto device was in three separate bands to get nearly three octaves of coverage. The only real difficulties were the failures of mechanical components.
So that's where your training came in handy.
Well, I didn't have very much control over the mechanical design at that time. We had we still have him, McAllister, you should see, who designed almost everything for radio astronomy receivers and antennas up to about 1960. And there's all the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Numerous telescopes and so on were designed, made very cheaply.
Yeah.
And I think this was one of the important things. We were able to get hold of a lot of things because of we can get very cheap designs and easily made, which gave us a big advantage over a lot of other people.
I've been told that Pawsey very much believed in this kind of philosophy.
Oh yes, he was string and sealing wax was. The only time that he didn't like string and sealing wax was when it wasn't good enough. That did happen.
Right. Well, of course, the key is the judgment to decide.
So
that's the case.
Anyway, we worked this spectrograph for a few months. Their recording system wasn't very good. It was a standard 16mm movie camera. And after a while, I came back to design a better system.
What were the troubles that you, the improvements you wanted to make?
Well, we wanted a much greater coverage.
In frequency?
In frequency. Yeah. We wanted a lower interference level, which meant a better sight, especially to go to lower frequencies. Sensitivity, a better recording system, and generally just more reliable. And so the I suppose I spent 18 months or so producing a new system, which was then installed at DAPTO.
And would you tell me again about the selection of DAPTO?
DAPTO was chosen because we knew that the site was very low interference from carriers. The being a swept frequency device, we were killed by carriers over various bands, and we monitored a large number of sites from an FM station in Sydney, and found that at DAPTO the station was just about unreceivable. So we chose that as a site, whereas sites further away still allowed stations to come in by back reflection or from hills and so on.
So here you had a hill protecting you from Sydney.
We had a hill between Sydney and us, and a flat plain for 15 miles to the back of us.
And DAPTO is now roughly how far south of Sydney?
60 miles.
Right, so did you commute out there regularly? That was a long...
The system we used to work was I would go down on Monday with Bill Rowe in the car. I wasn't married at the time, so I would stay on for Friday afternoon.
I see.
Bill Rowe would drive back on Tuesday, and Paul would also come down on Tuesday. They'd just change cars about and go back. It was always done by car. Paul would go back Thursday and Bill would come down. If there was any likelihood of solar activity, we'd also work the weekends. After we'd been there for about a year, we got an assistant locally who took over most of the routine running.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, perhaps. Tell me about the design of the new swept frequency receiver and what in particular what you worked on and so forth.
From the experience of the first receiver, we realized that we would need to go both up and down in frequency from the original range. And so the design target was to cover from 35 to 250 megahertz. 250 megahertz was considered to be the upper limit of the tubes and so on we were able to get at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And 35 megahertz was about the lowest frequency which you could work reliably without getting ionospheric transmission of signals from quite a distance. Furthermore, our intermediate frequency was 30 megahertz. This was traditional, but this was what it was needed to have a 30 megahertz IF for the higher end to get image rejection. And so the receiver which was built had three separate mechanically driven tuning gangs, the three receiver front ends on top of those. These were switched in consecutively to the IF amplifier, mm-hmm. So we built up the spectrum in three bytes. We had three separate rhombic antennas in a north-south line.
How long did it take for the entire sweep?
2 seconds. So our sensitivity over the bandwidth, which was about a quarter of a megahertz, wasn't particularly high in that, especially on the high frequency band, which was the time taken to sweep a quarter megahertz wasn't very long.
Right, but was that a real problem? Would you have liked to have had more, or were the solar bursts sufficient?
No, we would have liked to have had more. It was always a little bit of a worry. The strong stuff was okay because there was a lot of weak stuff which we would have liked to have seen. The noise temperature was pretty high. I think it was, for the high frequency band of the band, it probably was 2,000 degrees.
I see.
Something of that order.
And
which wasn't bad for the time. And for low frequency, and of course, the sky noise beats you.
So. Right. It's always a trade-off between sweep time and sensitivity, too, as well as the astrophysics. You don't want to take too long looking at the burst, right?
We had to
simultaneous picture.
Yes.
So I guess the only way out of this is to have several more antennas and receivers and so forth, and which is very expensive.
Well, yes, had we been able to go for a more elaborate system, but this already was an elaborate system for the time.
Oh, yes. Well, it was unique, was it not? Yes. I mean, was there anything even approaching it? I don't think there was until...
And Alan Maxwell built one later.
Right, but that was late in the 50s. This is many years later.
Yes, we had this one operating before the end of 1951. We installed Adapto and had the thing working. And then, of course, we hit the sunspot minimum. And for a long time we ran the thing, and we ran film continuously, and decided we're just wasting film. And then went over to monitoring every day for any sunspots, and if there were no visible spots, we didn't observe.
I see. And was that with a little telescope on site?
Oh, just a little refractor telescope, and mm-hmm. We project the image of the sun and say, well, we're not going to get anything today.
And what if it were cloudy?
Oh, we could find out from somewhere else. We could ring out. We had a telephone. Mm. Which we didn't have a love station. we could find out, but it generally didn't matter too much if you missed one day, because then only be just coming around the limb.
Right.
But we could... you had quite a number of people who could fail.
Okay, but now even if there were a day with spots, then what was your procedure to operate?
Well, if the spots were small, not many of them, we'd just stay around the receiver doing it. There's always plenty of work to be done. And if something came up, we'd turn on the cameras.
But you had a loudspeaker you were telling me.
We had a loudspeaker, which had made a characteristic sound, and you could very quickly pick some change.
Can you possibly give me some of these characteristic sounds?
Oh, it's hard to say. It's just a varying noise level, a few clunks, just as the gain varied slightly over the bands as we swept them.
Now, you would be sweeping constantly.
Yes.
Right. And so a normal sweep would sound like what? I mean...
Well, sort of shh, shh, shh. And then there'd be the dead spot where it got around the last quadrant to go back.
Right.
And then if there was something, the burst coming in, it was generally a narrow band, and there'd be a good plot
in the middle of the noise, I see. Mm. See, I haven't heard these things myself. So.
Well, it's hard to imitate them, but you can just imagine noise in three bands. Yeah. There was a little dead spot between each band. And
wouldn't possibly be any recordings of this around, would there?
I don't think so. We didn't have tape recorders in those days.
Well, but you might have brought one home, one out for that purpose sometime. And of course the other thing, it's easy to say now that maybe you could have done something differently in the design, but there really was very little knowledge of what you were going to find when you were designing this thing. You had some clues.
We had some clues. We had had some experience from the other receiver. We had enough to say, well, it's worthwhile doing. And therefore it was worthwhile installing a fairly elaborate system.
Right.
But for instance, we had no idea, and I think we'd have found it very hard to pick up from the other system, the fact that it can be the harmonically related bursts.
What would you have done differently if you'd known about that? I think your system took care of that pretty well, didn't it?
I think it took care of it pretty well.
Yeah.
The better sensitivity had helped quite a bit, I think, in picking up the harmonic stuff wasn't as strong.
And and the broad band was essential, of course, to see that structure.
Yes, to relate it to any. Otherwise, I think on the narrower band, you could have said, oh, well, they're two things just displaced in time.
Right. Well, it would have been possible, but much trickier to
much
deduce
trickier,
whereas what was going on.
It stood out immediately that this was a harmonic, because I had actually gone down on a Saturday to observe because there was a good spot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this big burst, so at the end of the day I hot-footed it back to the lab with the film and got it processed first thing Monday morning, and there was this beautiful harmonic burst on it.
Hmm.
Paul wasn't about. I showed it to Paul, who wouldn't believe there could be a harmonic.
So thought it was a birdie in your system.
Or something. He always asked all those questions. He always did ask all those questions. And, what was wrong with his system?
With the 16mm film that you were taking, was this going at the normal rate through the camera? Or?
No, in the pen, I can't really remember how I recorded Penrith. It was a standard camera. And we sat in the dark in a little hut, or almost dark. And then when something came along, we'd start the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it must have been just some method of photographing individual scans. But for Dapto, we adopted a different system. We got some very large oscilloscope tubes, some 12-inch electrostatically deflected oscilloscope tubes. Deflection was almost essential to get linearity. There was nothing like a TV tube we could buy here with a ready-made deflection system.
Mm-hmm.
So we got these 12-inch electrostatic tubes, they're image-made, and mounted those with their faces horizontal, and above that we put the camera shroud, and the cameras we made ourselves.
I see.
They held 100-foot spools of film, and the there was no shutter. The film was just dragged over a narrow slit, and we adjusted so that the scan line on the oscilloscope came along the slit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the display was intensity modulated.
And how long would 100 feet last you?
Oh, over a day.
I see. I run across some cans of those, by the way, down in the garage. Yeah.
Oh, you found some of the original film.
Right, I just took a look at them. Not much to see from my eyes. But
No, well, it was calibrated. We had some special noise diodes. And these were actually built into the receivers. And they could be turned on so that the noise from the diodes added to the incoming noise from the antenna. And by varying the current in the diodes, we could get a grayscale for the calibration.
So you were doing photo densitometry, or
right? Yes. Really. Yeah.
What sort of accuracy could you get in the overall calibration of a burst?
No. Plus or minus 50%, probably. Yeah. But this didn't matter much.
Yeah, sure. That's good. I mean,
we were never sure. You know, when you're processing a lot of film, we didn't calibrate all that often.
Another question came to mind. You mentioned about tubes and so forth. Someone else has mentioned to me that John Bolton used to smuggle some tubes out of the States that weren't allowed for export. I can't remember what kind they were.
Yes.
Was this a real problem getting various parts?
He was able to. This was much later, about the time the Parkes telescope was being
But I'm speaking in general here in Australia. Did you have trouble?
No, the real trouble with these was the tubes he was using had been developed by Bell Labs with their own repeaters.
Oh, that was it. That was it.
And they were just not available on the market.
I see.
He had had some from Bell Labs, and which they'd given him or something. We couldn't get hold of. Well, he did smuggle us a few of his. Then later we found that we couldn't get an almost identical tube, the identical internal mount in a different basing from England, from STC, IT&T.
I see.
These also were repeater tube. They were actually the output tube for the repeaters. They weren't designed specifically for low noise. This was just a bonus that
I see.
came along from the method of manufacture.
But I want to ask the more general question, though. Did you feel at a disadvantage to, in particular, the English groups at this time in the early 50s, that you weren't able to get equipment that you might wanted to have had?
We had very little equipment of any sort. We had a few multimeters. There was some equipment which was dated from wartime. But oscilloscopes were very rare. And
is this just a budget matter, that they were rare?
Oh, yes. I mean, the budget was very low. There was administrative matters, too, that You couldn't get another oscilloscope while you still had one in your books. And what did you do about the one in your books? Because unless it was so old, you couldn't replace it. And we were really hard up for all sorts of equipment. Later at Murray Bank, when I was getting the multi-channel receiver going, I couldn't see a sign of the line. I couldn't find out what was wrong with the system. It seemed to have the appropriate sensitivity and everything else, but just no sign of a line. And at the time, the Crisscross was being built, and they had a wave meter. I suspected the frequency was wrong. They had a wave meter, but it took me a long time to get the use of that wave meter for one day, because when I had it for the one day, I found that I'd chosen the wrong harmonic in the multiplier. Mm-hmm. Because I'd done the whole lot by just, well, I hope that's about right. I have no method of measuring frequency. Mm. And
so, well, this sounds to me, maybe this isn't fair, like an unenlightened policy on, as far as equipment goes, that you can't replace.
We had very little money for anything.
So it really was a budget thing, primarily.
It was a budget thing. Now I think we're relatively well off for equipment. This is a matter of the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Even Parkes was very badly equipped originally. We didn't get a computer in the place until 1969, and that was late compared with most of it.
Yeah, sure.
And so up to that time there was chart records, or we had our own system for punching paper tape, which came from an encoding disc on a recorder. We could get a tape touched,
right, which
was slow.
Which you brought back here and for use on computers here.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
But it was really, instead of taking out the strip chart from the recorder, we could get a paper tape from. All the rest of the system was the same. And,
do you want to take a tea break?
No, I suppose, yeah, would you like?
So, going back to the Dapto spectrograph, what were the primary scientific results that came out of the work there, in your opinion?
I think in the first place, the harmonic burst, which was the first thing we ever recorded, was the important one, and it gave a lot of insight into the physics of the solar atmosphere, of the upper solar atmosphere, and the mechanism of producing the bursts, and then, of course, there was a lot of other information came out, but it only confirmed earlier stuff. I think you'll find that the... already this is type 3 spectra. Now, the various types of spectra had already been defined from the Penrith stuff.
I see. That was clear from the Penrith already.
I think I'm pretty sure you'll find that this types 1, 2 and 3 have been defined from Penrith.
Mm-hmm.
This is...
But the fact that there were harmonics was...
this wasn't expected.
The real contribution.
I think this... yes.
And also the ability to actually calculate velocities, would you say, of movement of the exciting streams?
No, I think that had already been done. I'd have to check on these earlier papers of...
I need to do that too. I haven't actually looked at
them. Wilde and McCready, but I'm pretty sure that by the time they got through Penrith, that they recognised that there were these... Well, there were characteristic spectral features of various bursts which had been known. Of course, before that, they were known as noise storms and outbursts.
It just hadn't been systematized.
Well, they'd been systematized, but on a single frequency basis.
Right, right.
The spectral structure hadn't been defined, and so Paul redefined these as types 1, 2, and 3, and later a type 4. Now, another thing which happened at that, as I said, we got it ready for the solar minima.
Right.
And there wasn't very much doing, so we were a little bit desperate to think what to do with all this equipment. There was no burst coming along and not much chance of anything. So Paul became interested in the scintillations of Cygnus. Thought that to get some spectral information about these scintillations would be very useful.
Mm-hmm.
So we modified the receiver which took a bit of hacksaw work, which I had been doing, to use the lowest frequency band, where Cygnus is the strongest, and so on. And a rather slower sweep. And we just sweep the single band over and use the same rhombic antenna. Well, Cygnus showed up straight away that there was plenty of spectral information in the scintillations. And so we extended the system. We wanted to know what sort of scale these scintillations had on the ground. So we constructed in the vicinity of the original site three more rhombic antennas.
What year is this now?
'52 and perhaps 1953, but particularly now it was during the winter of 1952. We built these things ourselves, where there was plenty of timber at this site, and so we cut down trees and put them up as posts and strung wire on them. They were fixed rhombics because Cygnus has an elevation of only 14 degrees or something at transit. And we then swept each of these antennas in turn with a switching arrangement.
I see.
And well, there was quite a bit of correlation in the patterns obtained from different antennas. There were also differences. So we, you know, they had a ground scale which was perhaps comparable with our spacing, and it might be 1.5 kilometres. It's in the paper anyway, somewhere.
Right. But you were just as content to work on the ionosphere as on radio astronomy, it would appear.
Oh yes, I mean, there were a lot of people working on the ionosphere in various ways.
Yeah.
When a lot of Alec Chain stuff came back, really, it was a lot of it was ionospheric.
Right. So if I asked you, what did you consider yourself, if someone at a cocktail party said, what are you, what would you have answered in the 55 or that sort of time?
I think that I was a radio engineer.
A radio engineer.
I was concerned almost completely with the engineering of the project. I never had any astronomical, well, nor had anybody else had any astronomical training.
Right, but by this time many people were beginning to become astronomers.
They were beginning to become astronomers, but they're also, you know, they do as much astronomy as they need to understand the thing at the time.
Right. So just what was needed, more
That's
or less.
Right.
Yeah.
Paul, for instance, had read up everything you'd find on solar and the solar atmosphere and the stellar atmosphere and all the rest of the business. And, you know, he had a little bit of a break off. He wrote that paper on...
on the hydrogen line in the spectrum, that's right. I mean, when I talked to him, I want to ask him how in the world he got off into that.
Well, I think he had time to spare because he wasn't involved in any of the building, and there was a very small group.
Oh, I see.
There were only three of us, Paul, Bill, Rowe, and myself. Paul was a research officer, they called him at the time. I was a technical officer, and Bill was a technical assistant. And so Bill and I, well, we did all the acca of building the receiver.
I see.
I don't think we made any mistakes in we built something that was useless. We didn't know, well, Paul didn't know either, just what you could expect from such a thing, but we're, you know, sometimes these days you find monstrosities getting built which can't serve any astronomical purpose.
Because of lack of contact between the scientists and the engineers?
Yes.
Right.
There was an advantage of very small groups that if something was wrong in that in the concept,
right,
it'd probably be picked up pretty quickly. And also, we were quite prepared to modify anything.
Very flexible.
It was a very flexible arrangement. And this ionospheric scintillation came out. And so from DAPTO, we set up another field station. We got an old trailer from the lab and parked it at Appin, which is halfway between Sydney and DAPTO. And so we had a Yagi antenna at Appin.
How do you spell that?
This place.
Yes.
AAPPIN. And so we used to go up there in the middle of the night and turn the equipment on. It was battery operated.
Mm-hmm.
for about 3 hours and take our, it was only a single frequency, take our chart record back to Adapto and about 5 in the morning, and see if there was any correlation. I don't think there ever was very much correlation between the records at that sort of spacing, 40 kilometres. At that time also we had Govan Swarup helping us for a little while.
Oh yes, that's right, he was here. I have talked to him. Well, so these papers that you were co-author on, you were not primarily concerned then with the astronomical interpretation of these things.
No.
You're more concerned with building and maintaining the equipment and making sure it did its job right.
And about the middle of 1953, I was called back from Adapto, and that was the last association I had with it.
I see. And how do such callbacks work? I mean, is Pawsey more or less deciding who goes where?
And yes, he just decided who went where, and I wasn't very happy about it because I'd become very interested in it. At the same day, he must have filed all these things up for the one day because I hadn't seen John Bolton for a long time. I was talking to him in the corridor, and he was first, and he came out very disgruntled, and there'd been a lot of hard words because he'd just been taken away from Dover Heights.
This is when he went into rain physics.
That's when he went into rain physics.
But was that his response to being taken from Dover Heights, or?
Well, yeah, I think just an awkward situation had come about, so he went over to rain physics for him.
Right, but Pawsey didn't reassign him to rain physics, so that's what I'm getting at. It was Bolton's.
Well, he had him reassigned.
Had him reassigned. But he would have been content to go, if Bolton had agreed to go somewhere else. And
well, Bolton didn't stay there very long, went to Caltech.
Yeah. Right.
This was, well...
What year are we talking about now? When you
53. Yes, and John Bolton went to Caltech...
57 or something.
Oh no, it was earlier than that. Because Gordon Stanley went afterwards, and he left at the end of 1954. So I think John Bolton probably was at Caltech for nearly a year before that. It would have been the start of 54 that he went.
I'm going to talk to him.
But really it was the...
I'm just trying to get an idea of how... It seems, the picture I have is of many small groups at different field stations, like you say, not talking with each other all that much. And
we had very little communication.
And Joe Pawsey in the middle of pulling strings trying to coordinate all this.
Well, he used to visit each station very regularly. So one thing he did do that he, although he had these places all around, you'd get a telephone call and he'd be out for lunch and he'd probably have a visitor or two. And well, in case of Adapto, he'd come down for the evening meal.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you find these visits profitable from your point of view?
Sometimes we thought there were too many of them, but no, on the whole, he was pretty good. He'd go into all the troubles you were having, and there always were troubles.
Yeah, sure.
And, he'd quite often say, oh, yes, I'll get so-and-so to talk to you. He's been having something similar. So, he could.
So he was really coordinating things.
He was a good coordinator. Right.
Was he making technical suggestions of his own?
Yes.
Also?
Yeah. Oh, yes, he was essentially a radio engineer. He'd worked for EMI on television in England before the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he told the story once of how he installed the first television set in Buckingham Palace.
I haven't heard that one.
Oh yes, this was before Edward VIII. It must have been after George V died. And Edward VIII was king for a while.
Right.
It must have been about this time that he said, the present king, looking over our shoulders all the time, asking all sorts of questions about this man.
This was for some experimental broadcast they were going to have?
No, there was a regular television service in England from 1936 to 39.
A regular one?
Oh, yes.
I didn't realize
the BBC had a regular service.
For a couple hours an evening or something like that?
I think it was about 4 hours a day or something.
I didn't realize it was a regular one. I knew that they had some experimental things.
Oh, they were originally experimental, but they got to the Well, they might have been experimental, but on a regular basis, and some programming put into the thing.
Interesting. Okay, getting back to... of course, I'm always interested in things about Joe Pozzi, because I can't talk to him. Well, let me ask a general question, which is undoubtedly related to him. The success of radio physics, and in terms of being one of the leading groups in radio astronomy, what do you ascribe it to? What do you think were the key ingredients?
Everybody was pretty young at that time. For the first few years, there had been, except for people, well, Pozzi and McCready would have been about the only people in the group who were older than 30.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people with a lot of ideas. They'd had a variety of training. A lot had come from Sydney University, and mostly those people were electrical engineers, and they'd come during the war to work on radar. They had a very good basis training in radar, which of course, as far as the receivers were concerned, was very good for radio astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
They also knew a lot about antennas. They didn't know very much astronomy, and this was perhaps it, but they, you know, almost anything was there for the picking. It was hard to have a non-result. Everybody was very enthusiastic, and you could get things done very quickly. Because things were simple, you could get them done very quickly. There was nothing very official about getting a job through. Almost everything was done in an experimental job, mm-hmm. number, which wasn't costed.
Mm-hmm. But now, that something like that, though, is a function of the organization that it's part of. It might not have been set up that way, that you could get things done quickly. So it seems like there's an awful lot of autonomy.
We'd acquired, from being set up as a radar development establishment during the war, we acquired a lot of very good stuff for the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a terrific amount of experience in all sorts of things. Those people had not just done hack radio work, they'd been building our X-ray things with linear accelerators. And
right.
So, and so they were a very experienced team radio in electronic techniques.
And besides from the secrecy aspect you mentioned, about which had been learned during the war, there was also undoubtedly the aspect of, let's do it, and do it fast, and get it done.
We could do, you could get something started and working in a matter of days if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
There were, at that time too, pretty large stocks of various supplies, which were a hangover. The store was particularly well equipped with a lot of stuff.
So you could just sort of assemble things in tinker-toddy fashion?
We didn't have, these days you have to find out whether it's available, and they say, oh yes, delivery 8 to 12 weeks, and there's 20 days in every one of those weeks, and we never seemed to have those troubles. And there was, I think, actually, for what we were doing, money was readily available. Although we didn't have a great capital outlay, this didn't worry us for the first few years.
Mm-hmm.
It was only in the mid-50s where the wartime stuff was wearing out, and perhaps wouldn't have been adequate for what we were trying to do then, that we really started to feel the crunch.
Something else just came to mind that you told me before we started recording was the meetings of the solar physics group. You said they were weekly.
No, they were irregular, but more like monthly.
And this was this would be different groups, but all working on the sun, that would get together and discuss common problems.
Format varied, but generally it was a. At one time, people were working from the lab. They'd go to their field stations each day. They'd call in at the lab first. And so you weren't all that isolated. See, it wasn't difficult to get to Hornsby.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could get there by public transport. And you used to go to Penrith by public transport, although that did take a bit longer in travelling.